Welcome to the Plus Music Podcast with Brian Karsig and Nick Venti. Today we're sitting down with Jack Spallone, head of product at Hi-Fi Labs. Hi-Fi is an incubator for up-and-coming artists that focuses on live streams, metaverse concerts, NFT minting for new music, and other online experiences that return the power to the artists from the music industry. We touch on the consumer experience for music fans in 2022 and how new technologies are improving our relationships to art on a global scale. Here's more from Jack now.
Yeah, hey, Brian, and thanks so much for having me on. Nick and Brian, this is it's a pleasure to be here. Hi-Fi Labs is an incubator for artists and technology ideas in the music ecosystem. We've been around for a little over 2 years, started right before COVID after a couple entrepreneurs in the music industry were kind of working together for a while, doing different things like activations for artists, kind of thinking like, what does an incubator or a Y Combinator mean for artists, and how can artists do more things through technology? COVID happened shortly after the start of Hi-Fi Labs, which led to a lot of demand around live stream performances, those types of things, live streams as festivals, and things like Discord. And then as NFTs and blockchain kind of like, came back into vogue, Hi-Fi Labs found itself in a very unique position to serve that. That's where I came in. I have a background in crypto. I've been working in crypto for a little over 6 years. Historically, I came in from a perspective of rights management and licensing, which was a lot of the early use case for blockchain back in around 2015, 16. Yeah. You imagine smart contracts, royalties. Very intuitive, like, okay, yeah.
What happened to that, by the way, Jack? The promise of blockchain, I thought, was, fuck, that's a pretty great solution. But it's about adoption.
Well, I guess this is a good way to tell this story is through my history of working in this intersection. I used to manage artists, and I really, as a non-artist, wanted nothing to do with working in the music industry from a live performance point of view. Started as a promoter, went into management. It was incredibly futile. It's also not very secure. Working with established or even like up and coming artists for, where I was at. And I wanted to work in technology. That was something that I thought would be better suited for me. And at that time, I was really interested with like Bitcoin. It was finally being talked a lot about on the internet. This is around like 2013, 14 as something that wasn't like dark internet, like Silk Road, but actually like, hey, this could be a thing for social good. And I think a lot of the values that inspire the creation of Bitcoin were finally being understood in a more popular way amongst a wider audience. And I caught that bug. And then I had nothing to apply that to. I had no industry experience in this broad technology field, but music. So streaming was taken off. Royalties were absolute crap. Specifically like songwriting royalties. You may remember Adele and Taylor Swift didn't have their catalogs on Spotify at this time. So this idea of like smart contracts on a blockchain, which was being discussed within these communities and Bitcoin communities, was a very like, aha, like this makes sense. This could bring transparency to royalty payments. This could actually make them faster. This could actually resolve rights information. And then Ethereum came out, which is where, NFTs were invented. And that was like the crystallization of all of this theory. Fast forward, I was a part of many different conversations, many industry-wide conversations from 2016, really through 2020, where we explored a lot of these use cases, but there's just a really kind of like lack of aligned incentives to migrate entire music supply chains into new systems. There's just a ton of proprietary tools and businesses that are not willing to change. I found that, you can get labels and publishers to agree on what to do, but the DSPs won't agree with them. You can get a label and a DSP to agree, but then publishing won't agree. You can, have all three of those agree, but then distributors won't agree. And we're sitting on kind of this edge of what could be possible. But frankly, decentralized tech, blockchain tech, is really nowhere in a position to scale to the needs of what the actual music supply chain distribution and royalty payments would require. So there's a massive kind of like trade-off there. And a lot of that died. A lot of that went away.
Let me ask you, so there's some things there, right? Where I'm going to ask questions that I kind of know the answer to, but just for discussion. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, obfuscating the meaning, like keeping the details away from some party or the public is to the advantage of certain people, right? Like not knowing exactly how you're going to get paid, how much you're going to get paid from Spotify, for example, like where do I sit in this pay scale? Like who's getting that 0.004, or do I get that? Or do I get the other thing? You just kind of like, you just get something. That's one thing, but there's also like, you know, even from like a synchronization licensing point of view, which I know you have some background in, that's not really to the advantage of the licensor to let everybody know what everything costs for every deal, unless they were going to standardize it, right? Whereas like the industry of music is notoriously just about the deal, right? And you just have to work through it with somebody. How much does that song for what? Oh, what you can use it for? How many people are going to be there? How long? Territories, you know, and like, so all those, right. they all just stack up. But the promise of blockchain is great for the indies and for, you know, the people that don't have the control, but not so much for the people that control the best music in the world, right? So do you think that some of that adoption curve, like, is because certain people are like, well, we don't really need that. It's not like a need to have. It's a nice technology,
or but a want a need to have. I would think the big majors and the big boys just they like the opaqueness, if you will, opacity of the how. I mean, I get a royalty statement done in May that was from May of 2020. It's like 2 years behind in royalty collections. And if you want to know if it's right, you got to go back 2 years and contact all those people. For me, blockchain sounds like, you know, the Holy Grail coming to me and just showing me, wow, that's how it is. But you know, yeah, to speak to that.
There's this philosophy, right? That like, we have all this open data on a blockchain. Anyone can go and look at it and query it and search it, and all the transactions are there. It, like that's the philosophy of what makes a blockchain great. But there's a couple things working against it, specifically for like music royalties, especially in the streaming context. Transaction throughput per second is nowhere near where it would need to be to process actual market share payments of streaming. So like right now we pay on market share with most major DSPs. You don't necessarily get a payment per stream on the recording side. You get a market share of what your total streams are. Even batching that and doing it that way would be incredibly cumbersome, and reporting that data into an on-chain system would be expensive. You can make that network private and emulate like the actual blockchain-esque nature of the transaction log, if you will. But then at that point, it's not a blockchain. You have trusted parties running it. You lose the inherent trustlessness of it being operable by everyone. So you have these trade-offs that as soon as you try to scale for the need, you lose the value of even doing it that way. But I think all of that is separate from I really do believe, and I think this on a very long timeline, but we will move more towards public infrastructure settling transactions. You can have things like rights information obfuscated in a way where it's actually encrypted and it sits off chain, and through like cryptography mechanisms such as like zero knowledge proofs, actually reveal that information programmatically so that you don't know what it is, but you know verifiably that like this ISWC is being paid for this mechanical. I don't know the splits. That information lives off chain. I can't decipher the actual payment splits. But we are so far from that change. And in order for it to happen, like you need the entire supply chain to be in the system. It makes no sense for there to be like separate channels. Like, you know, you could have like your major DSPs predominantly owned by majors distributing to Spotify, But then like if DistroKid wants to build their own blockchain system with like TuneCore, it's still redundant. It's still redundant to all the rights databases. It's still redundant to all the royalty payment processors. So it doesn't make sense. It actually just becomes more expensive. And we were nowhere even near solving for so many of those other problems. I think it's not dead. It's just not the most exciting thing. Now we have a bunch of exciting things happening that exist outside of that paradigm.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a beat that dead horse, but it's like, you know, don't you have to get everybody to decide on a chain too and different ways to like, that's a, there's too many chains now. There's too many ways of thinking about chains. So
right.
I'm sure there's ways to resolve that down and to go, to bring it together. But what did you learn at when you were at Ujo? How do you pronounce that? Ujo?
Ujo was a company launched in 2015. It was the
I recall that company. What did you learn there when you were, that sounds like it was 2018 to 2020. That's like, or 17. That's like, was the peak in the, in the, in like, the
yeah. Crash. So in 2015, Ujo launched as like a project by Consensys. Consensys was the incubator for a lot of the actual infrastructure that makes up the Ethereum tooling ecosystem today, such as MetaMask. MetaMask is a Consensys company, the main wallet gateway to using Ethereum. Some of the like very early specifications and like protocols that are written as into tokens on Ethereum were developed by Consensys engineers. And the founder of Consensys really wanted to do something with music because just, again, the intuitive nature of how it could work. It kind of requires someone not to really know the intricacies or you know, be turned off from the music industry to have that level of ambition and spend any money on it. But in 2015, Imogen Heap did a single, Tiny Human, where it was like 34 rights holders sold 130 units, songs that use smart contracts to divide royalty payments. And it's funny, anecdotal, but each song was one ETH at the time. It was like relatively a dollar, just to kind of frame that in context. Ujo went a little bit dormant for a while, but then as things started to bubble back up and there was interest post some drama in 2016 with the blockchain ecosystem, specifically Ethereum, Ujo picked back up like right around and prior to the ICO phase to go after this like music market using blockchain. And the idea was really build a user-generated content platform, like really no different than what you have with Bandcamp, but allow people to upload works, like put in all of their actual information of collaborators, difference of recording and composition data. We forewent like ISRCs and ISWCs because we really wanted our like own separate sandbox. Mm-hmm. And we only required that literally everyone on the works was completely unencumbered, was not using a publishing deal or, you know, wasn't tied up in any like master like level deals, which is still complicating because if you collect through like PROs, like they collect for you, not at like the song level or the composition or recording, but like at the individual human level. So like you couldn't really opt out in some cases, but the result was like a supply side of artists that didn't necessarily bring large followings, but it was an experiment where we had, you know, a bunch of music being uploaded and published into contracts. Now, to give you an idea of like where we were at, we were not thinking like, oh, NFT is the song. We were thinking smart contracts divide payments instantly upon sale. And the sales happen in Ethereum or in ETH. What you do get, though, is an NFT to have a proof of purchase. So we did a lot of thinking around this, and my mind was on licensing. Like, what if all the songs you bought on iTunes went around with you on the web to every DSP you went to? What if, you know, all the songs you had on cassette, on CD, literally historically, all the purchases you ever made were denominated in an on-chain license that could populate the media file from somewhere? They weren't the media file itself, but they were a license. So at Ujo, we released what were effectively the first music NFTs ever released in 2017 as a proof of patronage, because we didn't go as far as calling them a license. But what I was excited about was like, if you have this and you bring this somewhere in the future, you will effectively be able to verifiably demonstrate that you made this purchase. And that basically was like my model of thinking, you know, if all purchases could be denominated in a platform agnostic way, you know, you don't need DSPs doing the licensing. The licensing would be actually transacted directly from consumers to the licensors, and they would be denominated in these assets as a license, or basically like a certificate that is the actual token. And that token could be transferred on a secondary market, and I could sell it, you know, to you, Nick, and then there could be a royalty share that goes back. And it actually, like, theoretically would grow the actual economy of music licensing. Because if the three of us wanted to go create a DSP today, we would, you know, stand to have to go pay millions in dollars in licensing catalogs, which, like, kind of reduces user experience and competition in the market, of course. But if we could just build an application where people could connect their wallet and bring their tokens that represent licenses, and then the actual media assets, or the songs in this case, could be populated from a server by, like, you know, a 7digital or something like that. Well, then that would be very fascinating. That would actually unlock a lot of new economy and value and allow it to grow in a way that we are potentially prohibiting right now. So
yeah,
that was like a big takeaway I had that still is not materialized.
Yeah. I mean, there's, it's like, I think that's a really interesting takeaway. I wonder this, do consumers care enough about ownership?
Well, I mean, that's why I said Bandcamp, right? But there's also, like, there's other economic models that I think are interesting. They're kind of like completely at odds with, like, statutory licensing and, like, how payments would work with, like, actual consumption of, like, a mechanical. But there's a model by a company called Resonate called Stream to Own, where you stream it and a streaming payment happens in the background based on a subscription. But after you stream it so many times, you actually just own it because you've effectively paid the full price for owning that individual unit.
And you own a digital copy.
Yeah. You own it, that basically, like, you have, like, what if you had a distributor that hosts all the world's catalog of music, and there's an ID for each one that corresponds to, like, a token ID. And if you have that token ID, you can unlock it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like,
I mean, I guess, you know, I've been paying attention to it, and I really like, I'm a fan of a blockchain technology. I'm a fan of the way people are thinking about it. Even when, I mean, this is startups, right? A lot of them are wrong, but the premises tend to have some kind of right, you know, and just happens to be timing or whatever.
Right.
I wonder if, you know, and I see what's happening with NFTs, and it seems to be bringing in a lot of revenue for artists right now, and a lot of excitement. And I asked that question really as, like, I'm curious what really matters to the consumer, because if the consumer that we are, like, our version of the world, I'm assuming we kind of all grew up in esque the same time-ish, right? Where we remember buying a CD, right? Like, mm-hmm. We bought music at a store at one point.
Right.
Like, that is not an experience that consumers have anymore. They can do it, but no, I don't know of any kids that do, right? Because it's just on their phone. Like, what are we in? So my question about, it's just a general, like, psychological question, because I'm super curious about what you've uncovered, you know, at Hi-Fi or in the past, and at Consensus, and just in the network and the world that you're in. How important is ownership to people? Or is it more about belonging? And is it what I like most about some of this stuff that I've been seeing come up, and I've just been paying attention from the sidelines, is, like, it seems to be more about community, because that's what music kind of used to be, right? It used to be like, do you know this band? Cool. No, borrow my CD, right? Now it's like, go listen to them. But there was something about, I have something of somebody's, and you know those people that never gave you your shit back. It's like, but, like, the there was something that you gave and had to give back. You listened to it, or you copied it at home and you had to give it back. There was a bonding to that. That's like that, like, very chromatic, like, Cro-Mag, I have thing, you need thing, give them thing, and we share. And, you know, so where, what comes up for you there?
This is like a very triggering topic for me, because I actually like another thing at Ujo that I like, you know, I was so obsessed with like royalties and licensing and like making the system more efficient that like, and like being defeated and kind of like on coming to grips with, you know, the industry not being in a position to change. I'm like, the fan experience sucks. The culture of music consumption and discovery sucks. It like, talk about Louis XIV. I think I had one of the Louis XIV songs as like one of my MySpace profile songs back in the day. And like MySpace profile songs were sick. Like what that was, whatever it was at that time, like said a lot about you. And if like someone made their song, like what you had after you had it, it's like, could you show that provenance? Like that was such a cool little cultural moment that like existed on the internet, was post-physical, was like, hey, we're not carrying these crates out and like DJing this party per se, like, you know, with these works that like we just happen to physically have, but like it did have that kind of like global reach, yet at the same time felt much more like community driven. And I think like the NFT music community wants to tap into that. I think there is like definitely a lot of that within the narrative, but the fan experience sucks. Like I'm not spending $3,000 on a token to join your community. Like it's a lot of it is driven by speculation, frankly. And I know that there are a lot of artists that like, you know, do make it much more accessible, but like, I want to turn the attention away from NFTs, because what we're not doing, and largely because like the financial incentive hasn't been there, but what this technology will do is you have identity through a wallet that can hold assets that live on a blockchain that does not belong to a Spotify, a MySpace, a Facebook, literally anybody. No one can take that away from you. It's solely between the issuer and those who own it or claimed it. So we've seen a lot of like, we've seen a lot of artists give away NFTs to say like, you're in my community, there's no barrier to entry for this. Like, I just want to have an identifier for that. And then they create like chat rooms that you need that to get into. And that's like really, really cool. But that's a very one-dimensional way of doing that. What we'll see in the future is we'll see actual relationships be denominated in behaviors online, such as like, I made this song my profile song, or I liked this song on this application, or I follow this artist on this application. That kind of information will be standardized and it will go with you from application to application. So if I bought your song on iTunes,
that's interesting.
It'll come with me when I sign up for Spotify. If I followed you on SoundCloud, I will follow you on Spotify. And this artist will have access to that information because it's not proprietary to the platform, but it actually is proprietary to the issuer, the artist in that case. And now we're actually like building vertical platforms or economies around the actual artist data themselves that only the artist really can have access to. So you can start actually having an understanding of like some demo data where it's like, hey, I noticed that you followed me, or hey, I noticed that you like me. Like, come to my website and provide me your email and I will give you an NFT. And that NFT might be valuable because you only have a month or two to do it. And if you hold one of those, there might be all sorts of like perks or something that come with it. So now we have like a bunch of new economic tools for actual music groups that are very, very compelling. And they exist completely separate of any application or platform, yet can simultaneously be built into any application or platform. And that will be the way in the future. We now have like shared data layers that we can build on. And I think that is like the connectivity that we've been missing in the history of the internet. That brings a lot more context to fan artist communities.
I mean, if you just could make the solve for what you just said of everything being standardized to, if I liked your song on SoundCloud, now I follow you on Spotify and also Instagram. The fact that artists have to live in a dozen different places right now, I loved it in my day. You just had to freaking have a studio and a ways to go out to go play shows. Like, you didn't have to be a part of 90 million different things to get your music heard out there, you know?
Well, right. I have a lot of questions about the practicality of what you describe, which is awesome. Like, I love that future, right? And how many people need
to that future
in order to, because, you know, you like, and I'm not trying to be like I'm just, for sake of discussion, the devil's advocate of, in order to get somebody's, to be able to get Spotify to allow you to bring something like that in, and basically an authentication from an outside party into their experience, and then authenticate over here, or, you know, like that's one thing. You are a head of product though at Hi-Fi. So, and you've been product lead, senior product manager. So you think about things like, I know what a product manager is. Tell us what a product manager is, and what do you do at a Hi-Fi, like on a daily basis?
So product manager is such a broadly applied term. Like a product manager at a label, you know, will treat like the actual music release like a product, and it very much is, of course. But product management at a software company is very different. There's like pretty institutionalized ways of doing things and methodologies for going about them. At Hi-Fi Labs specifically, as the head of product, I'm thinking a lot about the areas or gaps in the Web3 ecosystem, such as some of that I described here, where we actually have opportunities to go out and engineer solutions. Really, I need to break down things like, who's our audience for them? Are we doing a B2B play? Are we doing a B2C play? Are we doing a, you know, artist activation that leads into a feature set for a broader, bigger application that we need to build? What is the kind of like IP development strategy that we have? Where do we actually build IP versus support or fund external IP? What is our open source strategy? Things that we want everyone to use that will grow adoption the way that benefit our place within the market versus our proprietary strategy of building things that are our moats, if you will. So really it's like shepherding the actual business use cases with delivering and building things. In some cases, it's more hands-on managing the actual specific use cases with product and engineering team, or sorry, design and engineering teams. Yeah. But for the most part, at Hi-Fi Labs, we're a pretty tight group, and we're all pretty much on the same page. Where I'm pretty hands off with respect to the management of other teams, and really, it's more just kind of helping with the vision of understanding our place in the market and how to navigate that.
Yeah, that's cool. What have you done recently? That if people don't pay attention, what have you done recently?
Yeah, so. You know, one thing we haven't spoken about, but is this artist RAC. So RAC is, you know, pretty prolific crypto artist. You know, I worked with him back at Ujo, and I've worked with him over several years, doing a bunch of like different use cases using crypto. And at Hi-Fi Labs, we brought a lot of that all together, and we built a website that's his website, RAC.fm, where you can go to it and basically connect your wallet. And if you hold any token of his, you can listen to music that is exclusive to token holders. And if you're a subscriber to his Patreon, you can go and collect tokens every month. So those tokens are free. And basically, they're not for sale. You can't buy those tokens anywhere. You have to earn them by doing things. We don't mention anywhere that like, hey, subscribe to this tier and you'll get them. It's all retroactive. So like, if you actually do go and subscribe to something, like, you are potentially going to get something. And that creates this behavior where people are very engaged. And then they go to a Discord and there's token gated channels and they could join that. And it's a very much like in-group culture and like psychology. Like, we're all RAC fans, but that's just like what got us here. And now they have like inside jokes and different references and everything. So that's a very cool activation. But the website itself is like, you can imagine, It's emblematic of an operating system of the 90s when you go to it. So you land on it and it feels like you're in like a, you know, old Mac or like, you know, a Windows 94, if you will. And you've got like little applications on the side. And really what this is for us is a UX framework that allows us to implement new ideas as we think about them without like introducing a new drop-down menu and page navigation. Like it's a very like almost gamey feel where it's really like this like launch pad, you know, desktop for all things RAC related. That's one thing that we released it in the spring of last year. And right now we're working on a big project called Music OS. And Music OS is taking this basically a step further and making this available in a more self-service way so that any artist can create one of these pages and they can really like bring their own tokens. They can do these things. We've aggregated through an open source strategy that we have called Noom, all music NFTs that are out there. So you will basically be able to go and search music NFTs from multiple different applications. And we do this without the permission of any of them because that's the nature of this open data. And you can heart them or you can follow those artists, which is leading to that, you know, future that I'm describing where we're actually beginning to write that data to a data layer network that's completely open source. So we're going to be writing that information in a way that like, hey, this is a follow, this is a like, this is a list of songs that I created or a playlist. This is a song list of songs that's curated by many people or a chart. And we will have like identifiers for those differences. We will write all that information down to Noom, this open source data layer. And with the hope being that other applications will pull that information in, read from that data layer, but then also write their own data to it, either in the forms of event types that we've established or through suggesting their own through their own by, you know, making that request to the actual data layer that is new. So that's how this all works. On top of that, we have effectively like what is a creative agency arm. So if you want to like do something wild and crazy, but you don't want it to be like some ephemeral use case, we can potentially do it with you. And we can find a way that, you know, maybe this fits into Music OS and this could become a feature of Music OS. And we're willing to help subsidize the cost of developing it by structuring it in that way and making you a, you know, a very custom Music OS profile page. So that's the kind of way in which all of that works together.
Interesting.
Crazy. Yeah,
God, it's a fascinating future, right? There's so many like great ideas and companies that are building interesting things. Like, you know, there's out Waves doing out some really interesting sort of digital experiences, right? They're not, I don't think they're too deep in the crypto world, but definitely like just digital experiences, right? That are worth paying attention to. It comes to mind with like the Satoshi Enigma, right? That will probably have an artist that's more like a Satoshi Enigma type person that will just never know who it is, right? And people just absolutely love their music. And it might be some random like 75-year-old person, like some random part of the world happens to be like the greatest musician on the planet for that time. Those are just the fun like things that I could see when you start to live in a world where it's less about, you know, like the MTV times where you had a face for radio until MTV. And then those artists got changed because it all became about look and feel. And that changed, like the medium has really changed the music. How do you think about medium changing the music today? I mean, clearly TikTok's having a big influence on song structure and where artists can launch. But what do you think is the next medium?
Are we banking on an avatar rock star?
Yeah, like an NFT profile picture type band. Yeah, it's been discussed, but I think it's true in a lot of ways. You know, the mediums influence music culture, right? And it, like TikTok is by and large way more influential over the, you know, popular recording industry right now. And they're integrating in ways that are quite scary. It's like, okay, what's going to stop this from happening? Their algorithm can prioritize artists that they are now signing, and like they could become bigger than any of the majors. And it seems like it could happen rather quickly as long as people are spending a lot of time on TikTok. I personally am not like an avid TikTok user. I don't know if I should admit that, but I get most of my TikTok like a week later on Instagram through Reels. But I have likened the MTV analogy and what it did to radio to crypto and what it's doing to streaming. In a lot of ways, you could kind of like draw the very strong comparison between TikTok and streaming through like DSPs, but crypto and like community, like you have a much more like, it's not concentric around a single company. So in that way, like TikTok is much more like MTV, but the medium, the physical medium change here is this community aspect that is very much ownerless. And in a lot of ways, like that actually looks more like how like electronic music proliferated in like the 80s and 90s, where it was very underground almost. And there is like this small little groundswell of artists that are on Twitter doing Twitter spaces every day. They have Discords. They're all like really pushing at the edge of like what you can do with tokens and, you know, fan experiences. And it's incredibly small, like in comparison to things like what's happening on TikTok and, you know, even in streaming numbers, like you'll go to Spotify and, you know, some might have less than 10,000 followers or 10,000 monthly listeners. Yet they have 100 people show up every day in like Twitter to listen to them in a spaces, and they're technologists, they're doing interesting things. It's really, really different. And the only thing that really explains it is like, that's just a place where this culture is flowing. It's a possibility and culture is filling in that gap. It's just coming in and occupying it. Where it actually grows into and how it compares to the overall like pie of like music consumption and discovery, I think I really don't know yet, because of the cost prohibition of like, these things are expensive assets. And there's a lot of people under the wings that have never actually converted into buying one, but are interested in it. They're interested in the ethos of this space. But I do think that it'll actually just kind of be swept up and it'll be implemented in a way that, you know, you start to have like your MTVs, your VH1s in video format is a thing. And I think that's where crypto actually is the comparison. It's an actual new format, and you will have majors, indies, everyone alike using these communities that are decentralized, so that the things you do on TikTok are also happening in chat rooms, are also happening in centered around an artist's website, and they're kind of all over the place.
So you said a lot there, but I'm going to just zero in on one thing. It sounds like 100 people on Twitter, like, let's put that into perspective. If an indie artist got 100 people to show up to their shows every single day, that would be an achievement, because people get fatigued, right? So 100 people that are that engaged is a pretty interesting concept. It brings me to think about, does the, what I forget the guy's name, but is that 1,000 True Fans thesis, is that still valid in your opinion? You think that still works today?
I think that statement is so overused, but like that's like the internet, right? You know, that's what we could do. You can now reach 1,000 true fans, and if each one's willing to pay a certain amount, you know, on a recurring basis, then, and yet you like couldn't book a 10 stop tour and sell out with, or you couldn't, you know, book 5 people at a 10 stop tour, but you could have 1,000 people show up to a live stream, you know, every week. That's the kind of distribution that we have now that really, really puts the question to live performance agencies, how music distribution works with major labels. But I don't think it's, I think it's a net new thing, to be clear.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, when that concept is old, it's overused, and it is, it's like when it was written to today is like light years in internet years, you know, there's something there. Yeah, sure. Thesis wise, you described, like, if you could get this makes mathematical sense, you know. But if it's distributed, if it's distributed communities now, right, and getting into them becomes maybe a challenge or maybe not a challenge, those kinds of concepts are a lot less easy to prove and maybe less relevant with kind of way things are going, you know?
I think, you know, like creator economy, another term that's well overused. I think what happened with 1,000 true fans and creator economy, that actually it's right. It was just wrong when it was like more ubiquitously applied, was it required a centralized platform. I mean, you have like OnlyFans censoring people. You have Patreon actually like locking people into their payment integration, not because they want to, but because that's how they physically have to operate as a technical stack. Like, hey, you have all these subscribers per month using this payment subscription, like integration that we have. Like, you can't just go over there and like integrate with them. So you're still like locked in. And like, if you want to like exit, you can't bring your whole audience with you. You'll have attrition. So like, you can have 1,000 true fans, but do you have the infrastructure where they're mobile enough to go from place to place?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying we're there yet, but we now actually have a proper set of infrastructure to build that. And we have enough learnings to know why it hasn't worked, despite the theory of it being very economically feasible, and literally platforms like going off of that model and going up to huge valuations only to drop back down, where we can now say like, that's actually the future we need to design for. We need to make that much more accessible and possible, so that, you know, if an artist builds a following on MySpace or builds a following on SoundCloud or builds a following on Instagram or Spotify, when the next thing comes out, they don't have attrition of that audience.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's probably a good pause point, for our next conversation, because there's definitely a ton to keep talking about.
Oh my God. We got too much here for a part two.
Too much here.
Coming
soon. But appreciate your time, Jack. This is a great conversation. Curious to see, just keep us updated, and we'll keep an eye on HiFi and what you guys are doing. Anything you want to leave with the audience, where they could go find what you're doing next, where you can find you personally?
Yeah, I mean, I don't spend a lot of time on Twitter, but it's the most accessible way to find me. It's just my name, is my @ on Twitter, HiFi Labs on Twitter as well. But Nick, Brian, thank you so much for having me on. Fascinating conversation, and I feel like we're going to have to do some more.
Definitely.
We will. Awesome, Jack. Great chat with you. Take care.
All right. Thank you, guys.